Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony kicks off the city's fine arts season in the new year with a concert that features music that depicts places and a timeless story. Principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie leads the orchestra in Mozart's rollicking The Magic Flute Overture, which sets the mood for the fantastical story of Mozart's final opera. Contemporary American composer Michael Gandolfi's suite, The Garden of Cosmic Speculation, which is based on an actual garden in western Scotland that is devoted to depicting the science of physics, biology, and cosmology through landscape architecture. And in the second half, Sergei Prokofiev's adventuresome and tender score to Romeo and Juliet. The concert takes place Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie is my guest today. In addition to his duties in Tulsa, Heggie is the music director of the Wichita Symphony and the Binghamton Philharmonic in New York, and also maintains an active guest conducting schedule with orchestras around the country. He joins me today to preview Saturday night's concert. Daniel Heggie, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rich, as always.
And yeah, welcome to 2019 and the very first
Happy
weekend. You have a program right off the bat.
Yeah, we're starting right, digging right into it.
This is a very fun program, and it seems like there's a common thread that runs through all three of these pieces. What would you say that common thread is?
Well, it's basically using extra musical material. I mean, The Magic Flute is obviously an opera, so it has a story, and we're playing the overture to that. We're also playing impressions from the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, which is Michael Gandolfi's impressions on seeing a physical structure. So he used that as actually motivation to write the piece, and the musical metaphors he uses correspond to the various structures that Charles Jenks created as an architect in Scotland, this plot of land. And then the last piece, of course, is Romeo and Juliet. We're doing selections from the ballet by Prokofiev. And so that's also based on literature. So all three of the works have something that's extra musical or something that inspired the composers to write something.
Also a sense of cheeriness that seems to pervade most of these pieces. Now there's beautiful, somber portions of most of the pieces, but there seems to be a cheeriness, which I think, you know, once the holidays are over and you're into the January gloom, it's a great way to start the year.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, The Magic Flute, of course, the opera has almost everything in it. It's written as a comic opera or singspiel where there's singing and spoken word throughout, but it has profundity that's mixed with comedy and farce and Egyptian mythology and everything. So it has everything in it. The Garden of Cosmic Speculation also has these kind of serious moments contemplating physics and biology, and it's sometimes philosophical, but it's also sometimes whimsical and humorous and is very fast-moving and interesting. Kind of, as you mentioned, it's very joyous in many ways. Of course, Romeo and Juliet, it's a tragedy, but there are these moments in it, too, where Prokofiev can find the humor in what's going on throughout the music. So what people are going to experience, I think, is kind of a musical kaleidoscope in a way, because you're hearing a classical piece of music written by Mozart. So from that classical era, you're also hearing right after that this piece by Michael Gandolfi, which is quite contemporary, but he uses very traditional kind of harmonies in it. And then you're hearing Prokofiev, which had his own brand of 20th century harmonies, but still very tonal, I think we would say, and extremely melodic. So you're hearing three really different kinds of composers, and so I think it's going to be a real feast for the ear.
And I think the two end pieces where you have a classical era piece and a neoclassical, I mean, I think a lot of parts of Romeo and Juliet are very neoclassical.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, some of it you can hear, it's almost like something you'd hear from Prokofiev's own classical symphony. I mean, some of that writing, the phrasing and the cadences, of course, that are always surprising, I think, with Prokofiev. And enchanting. So yeah, you are bookending it in a way with something that sounds rather classical.
I have to say, Romeo and Juliet is my favorite ballet score of all time. It is a piece I can never grow tired of listening to, because the more times you listen to it, the more the skill of his talent as an orchestrator. There are all these moments where I was listening to something today that I never heard before. It's like in one of the movements, there's It's a sort of a rollicky melody, but at the very low, there's a bass clarinet at the very bottom of its range, mm-hmm. just sort of blowing this low note. Mm-hmm. And I go, I never heard that before. And it was like, there's all these things you listen for. It's just amazing, amazing orchestration.
Yeah, Prokofiev was one of the truly great orchestrators of the 20th century. He really knew how to fine-tune and detail exactly what he wants. Like, if you look at the score, it's sort of Mahlerian in the way that he passes one instrument to another or uses a certain timbre of one instrument to come out in one bar and then go back to something else. It just makes it so full of character all the way through.
Yeah. And as far as, you know, a lot of times ballets, you can hear that it is being a slave to the dance.
Yeah.
I never get the feeling with this piece.
No. The music seems to work on its own just fine. It tells its own story. It's in the music itself. It's very rich. You never feel like, as you said, it's not subservient to some other art form, but really is working to enhance it and also works great on its own.
When you're doing a piece for the dance, like a ballet score, but you're doing it in the concert hall, are there any special preparations you take, or do you really sort of say, okay, let's get rid of the artifices of dance and just approach it as pure music?
There is a little bit of that. Prokofiev marks in certain tempo markings that probably work well for what is imagined in terms of choreography. But I think in terms of just a concert suite, sometimes they work a little bit better at slightly different tempi. And so those are some of the changes. And also, because of some of the harmonic changes, one would normally, if you were doing it without the ballet, you could take a little bit of time to prepare that sound. Whereas when you're a slave to following the choreography, you'll get the dancers yelling at you. They'll see you as being indulgent because you took a little bit more time to go into a certain cadence. Because they, you know, ballet dancers need to have the music at a certain tempo because gravity is something that doesn't lie. If they're going up into the air and they're coming down, you can't just simply take time when you feel like it. And of course, I don't think when I'm making choices about interpretation, it's not just for whimsy, but it's because I think the music speaks better. So it gives you a little bit more latitude to really interpret and make the music all that it can be on its own.
Well, let's hear a little bit of music from Romeo and Juliet. And before we actually hear that, there's usually two ways you hear Romeo and Juliet. It's one as a ballet score from start to finish, or you hear the suites, which are actually pulled from all over the place, and they don't really tell the story of the ballet. It sounds like you're doing something different, where you're telling the story of the ballet through various movements of the suites.
Yes, that's true. As you mentioned, the two concert suites, they basically are pulling the movements from the ballet in no particular order. They make sense in terms of just having musical variety, like a slow piece and now a fast piece and whatnot. However, it doesn't really follow the arc of the story. And so I thought, why don't we create a suite, one major suite, that incorporates movements from both suites one and two, but put them in chronological order of the play, how it would actually be told. And so I like this version better.
Uh-huh. So what does that add to using the music as a pure musical experience?
Well, I think that the listener, the observer, can actually follow the arc. This is going from this, and it would follow naturally. This would be the death of Tybalt here. This would follow naturally that this is Romeo and Juliet's before her parting, and of course the ending, which is the tragedy, Romeo and Juliet's before, you know, at the grave. These kinds of things, I think, make it more poignant and more of an emotional experience to follow the arc of the story.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little music from Romeo and Juliet. This is a very familiar music. You hear it a lot of times in movie trailers and the like. It's just a great piece of music, the Montagues and the Capulets.
Yeah, this is a great one.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it starts off with a slow introduction, and there's dissonance right away, as you might imagine, from the two clashing families. And it's very, very, very loud right at the very beginning, loud chords. And then it goes to these very serene, quiet chords. It happens twice early in the introduction. And then you hear this very stern and it's sometimes dissonant, but it's kind of almost like the clashing of swords or something like that throughout Montagues and Capulets. And then it does have a very tender midsection. And then it goes right back to that very kind of warring quality to it. So that's what we hear. We hear the conflict of the two families.
Here's music from Romeo and Juliet to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Music from Romeo and Juliet by Sergei Prokofiev. Montagues and Capulets from Prokofiev's score for Romeo and Juliet. The Tulsa Symphony will be performing a suite of music from Romeo and Juliet as the high point of their concert Saturday evening at 7:30 with my guest, principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie. You know, one of the things I love about Romeo and Juliet is you'll hear this little moment and he'll go off into his own world, and then he returns to that moment at the end of some several of these pieces. It's the same thing. It's a very wonderful composerly skill, I think.
It is amazing. He'll bring back the music, but it'll be slightly changed. It'll be like something like you would imagine through refracted glass or something like that, because sometimes when you bring back the theme, it's the same theme as you heard before, but now it's changed a little bit. As the characters metamorphose through the play, we hear that in the music as well.
Yeah. And of course, the piece ends in this most interesting way. The suites end differently than the actual ballet, but it ends on the same C major chord. The way the suites end is with this very low C chord and just a high piccolo at the end.
Yeah, the lowest and the highest, kind of creating this open serenity, possibly hope for the future.
Well, contrast that with the Magic Flute Overture, which opens the concert. That's just a wonderful mix of this bit of sternness followed by jollity.
Yeah, absolutely. The beginning is rather stern, and oftentimes during Mozart's time, the overture didn't really have to play the themes in the overture that were appearing in the opera later. That happened a little bit later. But those chords that we hear at the very beginning of the Magic Flute is something that they recur throughout the opera at pivotal moments. And so we hear that at the very beginning. And it is a rather serious, slow introduction. But then it goes into this almost humorous, jocular fugue. It starts with the second violins. And it's just masterful in its invention. We can see that this is the last opera that he wrote before he died. In fact, just a few months after the premiere, Mozart died. And so we reap the fruits of his whole life, his maturity as a composer, and we see how masterful and concise and perfect the writing is. It's only about a 7-minute long overture, but he has everything in it. There's just so much going on with the counterpoint, and it is very jolly.
Now, this is a piece that orchestra members have played over and over and over during their career, I'm sure. What do you try to do to make it different or interesting, or do you just say, remember this as you're rehearsing?
Well, for me, it's always about going back to the score, because people hear multiple recordings or performances of the piece, and it can become maybe a little bit robotic. And so I always like to look and see, what did Mozart actually say? Like, where does this actually happen here? It's easy to kind of drift into I know this. Which is fine. I mean, that's good. We rely on, with a professional orchestra, one relies on that bank of experience and information that they have about playing the piece all those times before. But it's important to always look exactly at what Mozart wrote. And so I'm always just trying to make the music as vital and powerful as possible.
Any new insight from this look back to the score?
Well, sometimes I think about the tempo a little bit more. I think, okay, how can I make this transition even smoother? I mean, is this an expected place that it's going to go? For example, if I were a listener just hearing it for the first time, or is this something that has to be set up in a different way, or should we go straight into it? Those are the kinds of things I think about. But it really has to do with, I think, some of the contrasts and surprises that Mozart is creating. Because you look at the page, when you know a piece really well, things don't seem surprising anymore because you know they're going to happen. That's kind of the definition of knowing something, is that it won't surprise you. But you have to look at the music carefully, I think, and say, what is surprising about this work? What is something that's different than the norms of expectation of that time? And you try to highlight those. That's what I try to do.
Yeah. Well, the new piece on the program is this, The Garden of Cosmic Speculation by Michael Gandolfi. This is a very, really interesting piece. You're doing what is called the Impressions of the Garden of Cosmic Speculation. The Gardens of Cosmic Speculation is a piece that probably is not even yet complete, because as the garden changes, it's an actual garden in the west of Scotland. Michael Gandolfi is adding more movements to it.
He will continue to do so, as he has said. Right now, there are 11 movements total. He wrote the first four, and that's what we're going to play. And the composer has specified that anyone can take one of the movements, two of the movements, four of the movements, seven of the movements, any subset or group of them, and perform them as standalone works in any particular concert. We've decided to do the first four that he wrote after he wrote those in 2004. And the Tanglewood Music Center premiered them with Robert Spano back in 2004. And then in 2007, Gandolfi decided to write the other seven movements for the 11 total movements that are there so far. But he has said, yes, when there are more of these areas that are developed in the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, I'll be writing more movements. So the entire thing is about 85 minutes or something like that. Our four-movement suite is going to be about 22 minutes or something like that. And they work very nicely. And it's interesting to see Gandolfi's reaction to Charles Jenks' work, the Garden of Cosmic Speculation. As you mentioned, yes, it is part of it's a 30-acre plot of land in Scotland. Charles Jenks is an American architect, and he's thinking about these things about biology and physics and philosophical kind of ruminations when he built these various parts of the garden. Gandolfi read about it because Jenks wrote a book about it also. He read the book cover to cover and was so inspired. And he was also asked to write something for the contemporary music program at Tanglewood Music Center. So he thought, I'm going to write four movements right now that are my reactions to different parts of the Garden of Cosmic Speculation. So it's very interesting to hear his take on them. And it's interesting how he uses kind of a musical metaphors. He creates his own musical metaphors based on the architectural metaphors that Charles Jenks created.
If you look online, just the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, you'll see pictures of this garden, and you see like this cascading hillside where you see the double helix of the DNA. You know, mm-hmm. You'll see this representation of quarks and these wonderful structures that are everything about physics, biology, and everything of what we're learning about life on this planet and what we're speculating about.
Cosmic speculation. That's what it's all about. So you might imagine, as you might well imagine, the piece is it's abstract in a way, but it does feed into whatever title of the movement it is. So at the very beginning, when you have the zero room, that's what we start with. That's your first entrance into the garden, and it's laying there before you. And so what you hear is like you hear these birds chirping, and you hear a rather placid sound in the strings, and it's just changing very slowly. Just it'll go from A natural to A flat within the chord. It's just this beautiful bed of sound. And then you start to hear these 16th notes coming in the orchestra, and they kind of phase in and out, and different timbres, different harmonies come in. And throughout that first movement of the zero room, you start to hear things kind of change and metamorphose throughout the movement. And then you go to the second movement, which is soliton waves. And that's really talking about the idea that soliton waves can join another wave and then go back without having any real recollection or memory that it had joined something else. And in this, you as you might well imagine, the music is it's very fast, it's very active, and the wave motion is kind of an undulating sound that you hear throughout the orchestra, where these wide skips, and it's very active music. And one instrument will join the music and go to a very high range, and then to a very low range, and throughout the entire orchestra. So that's a fascinating movement. And then the third movement is The Snail and the Poetics of Going Slow, which you might imagine is very serene and is experimenting with all kinds of timbres, harmonics in the strings, percussion. It's very evocative. And this is kind of a centerpiece. It's basically a realization of the slow turning of the earth. So that's kind of a pivotal moment. And then the last piece is The Nonsense, which is fairly postmodern. And as you might imagine from the title, The Nonsense, it's using basically components that don't seem very functional on their own, but when they are all combined, they make kind of an overall global sense of making perfect order. It's a really fascinating work, and I hope the audience really enjoys this.
Now, when you have a piece like this that has such an explicit program, you know, it's based on a book, it's based on a garden, the music score is there. Mm-hmm. Where do you start? Obviously, you have to start with a score, but do you go back to these other sources, or do you just look to the score for the guidance on how you approach a piece like this?
I think it's interesting to go back to the source material to look at some of the aspects of the garden that Michael Gandolfi was influenced by when he wrote the piece. But for me, it's more important to simply look at what he said in the notes and try to understand it in the best way from the text itself, from the music, and just look at the notes and see what he's trying to say, see the connections he's trying to make in creating the melodies or creating certain connections from one section to another. And then I think the music speaks for itself.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that music so we can hear it speak for itself. This is from Solotone Waves, the second movement of the Impressions of the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony this Saturday night. That's music by Michael Gandolfi from the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. My guest today is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor of the orchestra. And I assume this is a brand new score for you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. I had heard about it years ago, but I hadn't really had the opportunity to perform it. And so when the artistic committee came together and said they wanted to do this, I was excited about it. And I looked at the score and I said, this is really fascinating piece of music. And it's also very interesting that both Charles Jenks is still alive and is an American, even though this is created, the architectural garden is created in Scotland, and Michael Gandolfi is an American composer as well. And so you're really hearing a bit of Americana, even though Charles Jenks, like I said, this is in Scotland, but the roots are from American sources.
Well, you know, and of course it is this representation, you know, the landscape is a representation of science, and I assume the music in some way is an amalgam of the science and the landscape.
Right. I can't speak for Michael Gandolfi on this, but I think it is probably a mixture of Gandolfi looking at the architecture and trying to create some sort of impression or reaction to it, but also incorporating what those ideas mean. Because obviously, if you're trying to create something in sculpture that is representative or metaphorical of things in science, it is abstract by nature. And so I would only imagine that Gandolfi was trying to incorporate both the science itself and what he saw in the Garden of Cosmic Speculation.
As we hear from this selection we played, it's also very accessible,
oh, yeah,
very vibrant,
exactly,
contemporary music.
Exactly. I think sometimes people get a little nervous if they hear...
Well, when you hear all this program that's a part of it, too.
Right. People might hear, oh, my word, you know, it's written in 2004. That's pretty recent, and I don't know if I'm going to like music that's been written that recently. But I like you mentioned, the music is quite accessible, quite easy to listen to. It's very active, and it has a very familiar tonal language overall. So I think people are going to be really enchanted and mesmerized by this music.
It's funny. Classical music is the only music where people say, oh, it's new. I don't think I'm going to like it. I mean, most of the time with any other music, we look forward to new music.
Right, right. I think people have, you know, felt like classical music kind of went on, you know, by the wayside a little bit in the 60s, and some of the modern music then they didn't find it as accessible, of course. But I think in recent times, a lot of composers have kind of come back to wanting to reach out to people and wanting them to really enjoy the experience. And I think that's important now, that when people hear a piece of contemporary music, that they really enjoy it the very first time, rather than say, well, you didn't get it this time, but maybe after the third or fourth time, you'll like it. people don't have that kind of time or that kind of inclination anymore. I think we need to reach out to people and kind of, you know, grab them the very first time they hear it.
Yeah. The first orchestra rehearsal was last evening. Mm-hmm. What was the reaction to the orchestra the first time they actually hear it put together?
Well, I think it was excitement. The Gandolfi, of course, is not familiar to most of them. And so I think it's surprising music. And when you're just looking at your own individual part on the page, it only makes sense in the way that you see it. And when you start to hear the other parts, it starts to make sense in a more global context. So I think that was the adjustment period for us, was just to hear all those other parts getting put together and making sense of some of the metric modulations that Gandolfi wrote throughout the piece. And once they started to hear that, it really started to go very smoothly. But it's always, you know, it's always tricky the very first time you're introducing a challenging new work to play. Again, I don't think it's challenging to listen to, but I think to play sometimes just to get it familiar with all the players.
Is there a lot of virtuosic elements to
it? There are.
Some of the players?
Yes. I mean, it's technically a real challenge. Some of it is difficult to play, but it's nothing beyond what they can do. I mean, they're going to do a great job.
Yeah. All right. Well, we look forward to the results on the stage Saturday evening. Daniel, as always, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Great to be here, as always.
Daniel Heggie is the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. He'll be leading the orchestra in this piece, music by Michael Gandolfi, Mozart, and Prokofiev, Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Visit tulsasymphony.org for concert details. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher.
A new year, a new Congress, and a new speaker with a familiar face.
Our nation is at an historic moment. 2 months ago, the American people spoke and demanded a new dawn.
We'll look at Nancy Pelosi's historic return to the rostrum, what a Democratic House majority means for President Trump, and the latest in the continuing shutdown, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Saturday morning from 7 to 10 on Public Radio 89.5.